Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Seeking What They Sought. I'm one of your hosts, Anthony Leiter. Happy 2019, and I hope the holidays have treated you with plenty of delicious foods and beverages and times with friends and family and all the things that the holidays bring. As for us over here at the podcast, we have a ton planned for 2019 that we're super, super excited about, so be sure to keep your eyes open for that. On today's episode, we spend some time debuting a new series that we're calling Bad Explanations, and we get to dive into our first topic, which is sex before marriage. And I don't want to spoil anything, so without further ado, welcome to the party.
Hey everyone, my name is Jesse Churchill. I'm a pastor up in Washington State.
I'm Anthony Leiter, as I previously mentioned before, and I live in good old SoCal. I'm a youth pastor at the La Sierra University Church.
And I'm Sean Lenhoff, and I teach at San Gabriel Academy in Southern California.
It's 2019, guys.
It is. Happy New Year.
Does it feel different to be in 2019?
For me, it does.
Sean?
Yep.
For you, it does.
Yep.
Why is that?
Okay. I'm going to be a father in less than 2 months.
That's nuts.
You're gonna
Are you
dad.
Ready to be a father?
That is the number one question I've gotten. And
I'll answer this for you. No, you're not.
Yeah, I don't know what the answer to that question is. I don't know what ready means.
See, here's the reason why I don't think you're ready, Sean, and I don't think you ever will be. So I'm going to tell a little Sean story. So Sean and I were roommates for about 3 years in college, and 1 year I was in the bathroom. This is going to be a very just if you didn't realize this about this episode based on the title, you don't want your kids listening to this, so I feel comfortable sharing this here.
We're safe.
I'm sitting on the toilet, and Sean starts going, Jesse, come here, Jesse. And I'm like, what, Sean?
I remember this.
I'm not able to move. Like, this isn't just a get up and come over there situation. Like, Jesse, come here. Something smells like something's burning. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And he's freaking out. So I have to take care of my situation real quick so
right.
I can get there quickly. And I get there, and all that had happened was that a power strip had kind of like shorted, and so some smoke came out of one of the things, and Sean was freaking out. I had to get off the toilet in about maybe 15 seconds. Like, it was pretty quick, and go in there for that. And I had to go back to the bathroom after. Like, I wasn't done.
You paused in the middle of this regularly scheduled programming, is what
exactly.
You're
and yes, and so Sean, I just have concerns that like
about his emergency reaction time.
What are you gonna do when something's burning? Are you gonna start calling for your baby? Like, baby, come here. Something's burning, and the baby is gonna be like, I can't speak. Like, what's gonna happen?
That's what he will say.
So I'm not going to defend myself against that because in the heat of a moment, I can sometimes get a little stupid. I won't always think things through. There was a time when Rochelle wasn't feeling good in the middle of the night, and I woke up and I was trying to get ready quickly to help her, and I turned my lamp on so bright that it blinded me. and I was yes. incapacitated for a good 10 seconds. So I
That's amazing.
And my brain,
you sabotaged
to be
yourself.
Fair, to be fair, my brain hadn't woken up. It was in the middle of the night. And the one that Jesse spoke about was not in the middle of the night. But
no, that was in the middle of the day.
But
yeah.
that's my first thing is I'm not going to defend great. Myself. But I'm also going to mention, Jesse, that I don't feel like you're any more qualified. Because for every story you can say about me, I think I might have 10. So yeah. I'm gonna leave it
this,
at that.
There's this idea. There was this idea in the Cold War called mutually assured destruction.
Yeah,
which meant
that's
that
what this is.
If one nation launched off a nuke, like everyone was gonna launch them off and everyone was gonna die. That's what our friendships are. Like all three of us, including with a couple other guys. Like
it's
we
true.
All know too
Got
much
too
about
much,
each
too
other.
Too much dirt.
The one night where we all just shared our deepest secrets. And at this point, it's like we have too much dirt on each other. So if one brings up one in public, then I can just bring up. Anyone
it's
else's.
Over.
It's just over.
Yeah.
It's just we're all going
We'd
down.
We'd all be ruined.
If I'm going down, I'm bringing you down with me.
that's true friendship, folks.
Yeah, exactly.
Friendship, Christian fellowship in the form of
Christian
friendship.
Christian fellowship in the form of friendship amongst men.
Destroy one another. John 3:14.
We should talk about our new series that we're doing.
It's called Bad Explanations. Why is it called Bad Explanations?
I think that when we were talking about this, we were talking about how we, when we were growing up especially, and even when we were teenagers, like, you get all of these terrible explanations for things. Like, for instance, you know, I was always told you got to dress up for church, right? Because you got to wear your best for God. And it was always passed off like there was biblical, there's a biblical basis for that, for why I should dress up to go to church. And then as I grew up, I realized there's no biblical basis for that. And all of a sudden you realize, like, well, why was it passed off that way? Why was it explained as though, oh yeah, this has a good reason. There's a good reason for this. You know, but then you grow up and you're like, I get the idea that, oh yeah, it's God. Like, maybe I shouldn't come in, you know, the worst clothing I have. But at the same time, there's no context for why I have to wear a suit. You know, why I have to wear a tie and all of those different things. So that's one of the bad explanations. That's like a really basic level one. But there's a lot of things like that. I don't know. Maybe you guys have examples too.
Yeah, I think for me growing up as a pastor's kid, church is an easy topic. There are plenty of other things, but I think, like, I remember in particular, my dad had a huge thing. My dad's a pastor. I think I've said that before, but and I love him a lot, but he had this thing with hats on in church. Like, it wasn't even just the sanctuary, but it was in the church building in general, but especially in the sanctuary. It was like, you could not wear a hat in the sanctuary.
Even, like, or, even if it wasn't Saturday.
Yeah, it was like, you, like,
just in general,
take your hat off. That's disrespectful. This is a holy area. And then as I grew up more and read the Bible for myself, I realized I don't find that anywhere in the scripture. Yeah. Like, it's definitely a cultural value. But, and the explanation was all, I'd always be like, well, why, Dad? And, you know, it was always like, you know, because this is a holy place, you know, like, you would take your hat off if you were meeting the president, you know, something like that. And I was like, I don't know if I would. I don't really share that cultural. Maybe this is a
especially now.
Yeah. So.
Well, but even now, like, yeah, I know why you're saying that, Sean. But at the same time, like, even now, like, if I'm wearing a hat that day, you know, and it's part of my, what I'm wearing,
it's part of your outfit.
Like, there's not really a reason to take it off. There's just a different cultural value.
I think it's just a generational. But
part of the reason we're doing the series is because then it was passed off to us, like, it wasn't just a generational value. Right. This is a timeless value.
Right. It's like a timeless value with spiritual implications. Exactly. So if you don't do this, it's like, wow, is God like angry with me or dissatisfied, or, you know, like, does God look at me differently if I'm wearing a hat in a sanctuary? And then, you know, there's all these underlying weird presuppositions, like, you know, like, God's presence is in the church sanctuary, which is, you know, we can get into more about that, but yeah, you know,
we're going to do a whole episode on church and worship and stuff, but
yeah,
for sure. Sean, do you, I know you're a pastor's kid too. Did you have any from your parents or maybe even just from people in the church or?
Oh yeah. I mean, the ones you mentioned, dress, and I mean, no food in the sanctuary, no running in the sanctuary. You know, I mean, it's hard to think all of them off the top of your head, but I mean, it always resulted in, I don't know, as kids, you always tried to find a way around it. Like, I just remember in church, like, you just tried so to find a way to beat the system.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It was interesting because back then, I don't know if I really questioned any of those things as a child. I wasn't one of those kids that really questioned it. I would just be like, forget that. And I would try to find a way around it. I would never sit down and be like, is there a biblical passage that defends this position my parents took or this elder took in the church, you know?
Well, and it's interesting too, because, I mean, we've touched on some, I think, almost surface level concepts, but then you get into stuff like alcohol where, and we're going to have a whole episode on that too, but, you know, where I was always told alcohol is bad. It's awful. It's never drink a drop of alcohol. You know, and then you go through the Bible and you're like, if anything, the Bible sometimes glorifies drinking, you know, not in like over drinking, not getting drunk, but like it glorifies the consumption of alcohol at responsible levels.
Or at the very minimum condones it.
Yeah. At the very minimum.
Yeah.
And you're like, wait, why did you just feed me this idea that the Bible is completely negative about alcohol? Why did you feed me that idea when it's clear, like you guys know, and I know I don't want to talk about alcohol too much because we have a different topic, but you guys know that how many times you heard, like, people try to justify the fact that, well, Jesus turned water into grape juice, mm-hmm. not actual fermented wine,
mm-hmm.
you know? And like, maybe that's true, but it's like, we're so stuck on this alcohol has to be bad.
Yeah.
That it became this thing. And it just felt lazy. It
yeah.
just felt like, once I started reading the Bible, that explanation just felt lazy. It was a bad explanation.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe alcohol is bad, but it's not, what it's like. That's not what the Bible is saying.
Yeah. And here's the thing too. Yeah. Like, if I'm going to look at it, like, when we're talking about all these topics in this series, we're not necessarily going to go up against every single principle in our church and say, oh, that's wrong, we should do it this way. Mm-hmm. It's more about, like we said, it's about the explanation. How are we going to have these conversations
right,
that yeah. lead us to healthy conclusions about
yeah, yeah.
what actions we take? That's more what we're looking at. We're more looking at how we need to change the dialogue in our church, not necessarily mm-hmm. the actual teachings. And maybe yeah, maybe sure, there are yeah. some that we're like, hey, we should change this. But again, we're not going to set out and saying you should start consuming alcohol right away. That's something that Adventists should all do. That's not
right.
that's yeah. not the point with that or with all the other ones. It's about how we talk about it because. As we'll get into with this episode, there's just a reality. There's a reality mm-hmm, yeah. with the people that are doing all these things in and outside the church, and we just mm-hmm. have to address it in a healthier way.
And I think to follow up with the Ushant, yeah. sorry, Jesse, I didn't mean to.
Yeah, go for it.
To follow up, I think, like, in coming to healthy conclusions, we also recognize that some explanations and principles that we were taught growing up are actually damaging and hurtful mm-hmm. and actually oppose the gospel and oppose the Bible. So, you know, the idea that I have to bring my very best appearance before God, which is an idea I think a lot of us were taught, at least I was, you know, as yeah. far as like dressing up, all the like you have to look nice, and it's just so ingrained that once later on in my life when I realized, wow, like it's this interesting works-based idea that like when I bring my best before God, that's what I do, you know, to like to yeah. give him a thing. But the whole essence of the gospel is that my best will never be good enough for God. And in fact, it doesn't need to be because Jesus was the best for me, you know?
Exactly.
And in fact, my very best and my best good efforts are, you know, like to God, he looks at them and he's like, sorry, that's not good enough. You know, it's like filthy rags,
yeah.
you know? And so when it,
so the bad, what you're saying is the bad explanations even led to an unhealth, not just like,
yeah.
oh, it's a bad explanation, but it leads to unhealthy understanding of the gospel.
It leads to unhealthy, yeah. And I think a lot yeah. of these topics, and the one we're going to get into today, sex, I think in particular, because it's so intricately connected to the gospel and God and the story of his love and the picture of his love for people that I think, like these lazy, bad explanations, I think, can be super damaging.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually, on that note, why don't we transition into our topic for today? Which is about sex. And I totally agree with you, man, especially with sex in the way it's been talked about. And maybe our first question is, what were we taught mm-hmm. about sex growing up? And specifically, sex before marriage.
Right.
I think, you know, there's this kind of this idea of once you're married, then you never have to, you know, talk about, we could have
guilt-free sex forever.
Now. We could talk about that
yeah.
Another time. But we were always taught things about, you know, you have to save sex for marriage. And I don't know, at least I was told certain things. Here's why mm-hmm. you shouldn't have sex before marriage. You could have unwanted pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
You could get STDs. I remember literally, like, you know, in sex ed classes, not that this is a bad thing,
mm-hmm.
but this was maybe one of the only things I was taught about why not to have sex is, you know, one time in a class, in a sex ed class, we literally had like the list of all of the STDs and what they were and how bad they were.
Yeah.
Which is maybe educational and you need to know that.
Right.
You know, but it wasn't, it was never, I was never given a good, like, emotional reason.
A thoughtful reason.
Emotional, yeah. Yeah. Like the only emotional reason yeah. I heard was, you know, because you're not married and so you're just not ready yet. And
yeah, yeah.
I don't know. I heard a lot of things that just never really clicked into a good reason. Not to, maybe. I don't know. What were your guys' experiences? What were you taught about sex growing up?
Oh man, it's hard to think back, but I feel like a lot of what I heard and what was taught was a lot of this like purity and shame culture, especially. So, you know, like if you were a virgin until marriage, you were pure, and that was called staying pure, and you know, like being a pure person. And but if you didn't, then you were impure. And I don't remember if that was, you know, unnecessarily like stated up front. But it was, you know, this idea that like you lose your purity. And so it was like focused like this whole focus on maintaining purity. And if you didn't maintain purity, then it's like a lot. And I want to get more into this later, but the idea that your whole identity is sort of wrapped into like your sexual purity.
Yeah.
I don't think at the time when I was growing up, I made these conclusions, but I think later on in reflecting back, but yeah, I need to think more about specific things. Sean, what do you think?
Yeah. So, I mean, it came down to, I think for me more in school. Now, I mean, I got the classic things at home about, you know, saving yourself from marriage or anything. But honestly, I just remember more at school, more prominent memories of what Jesse mentioned, where we watched, like, I remember a video series on, man, I can't remember her name. It was some lady that was presenting in front of a large crowd, and a lot of them were teenagers. It was hilarious to watch because all the teenagers were with their mothers in the audience.
Oh,
and you could tell, like,
that's the best way to learn about sex, honestly.
You could tell though that the kids were like, I can't believe my mom dragged me here. Like, you know, it was miserable.
This is the worst day of my entire existence.
Yeah. So it was kind of funny to watch that. But like, she was, you know, really passionate telling stories about story upon story of how she's seen broken couples coming to her with the stories about STDs and brokenness, and how he left me out to dry because once I had sex, he abandoned me and I was called inappropriate things, and I was looked upon as, you know, kind of the whore at my school, and just terrible, you know, these terrible borderline fear-mongering stories. And like Jesse said, these are real stories, right? So it's not that we shouldn't be aware of them, but it's the only rhetoric that you hear at all, right? So so, and then usually what happens is by the very end you get a short section that speaks about how sex is beautiful. It was created by God, within the context of marriage. So just wait for it. It's going to be beautiful.
The 5-minute conclusion. Yeah.
But you just got to wait for it, and it'll be beautiful then. But there's no other explanation. It usually spends 90% of the time is on the downside of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest is briefly touching on the beauty of marriage being a good place for sex. But it doesn't really get into how it's a beautiful thing or the purpose of it. Maybe sometimes there were a couple Bible verses we go over that were talking about the purpose of sex and all that. But again, it was very brief. I don't have any memories of really having discussions in class or
I don't either, actually.
In the church about
good ones.
Not until I was in high school, I think. It took until high school that we started getting conversations. And I remember probably the most impactful speaker in high school for me was at a camp meeting when I heard Pastor Matt Gamble give talks about the importance of the mind and sexuality. And I think that was a big breakthrough for me personally.
Yeah, Sean, you brought up an interesting point as we were discussing stuff in the lead up to this series, that because we were talking about how bad explanations, it's like, you know, we heard all these terrible explanations, or at least like really incomplete pictures of, because maybe you need to know about STDs and the dangers of them.
Yeah.
But when that's all you hear, and Sean, you brought up that it's really hard for, like, especially parents or adults. How do you teach a 12-year-old about sex in a way that they're going to understand? How do you teach even a 15, 16-year-old? Like, you guys know how, especially three of us boys, you know, in high school, every time someone said sex, like, we were in the back just dying.
Yeah, we were the immature kids in the back.
Yeah.
Like, and so how do you teach those kids about sex? You don't, really. But here's the problem that I think we all, that I think, Anthony, you said this.
Yeah.
Because you said, yes, that's a problem. But the problem is that we never heard the adult explanation later on.
Right.
You know, we always only ever heard the, because maybe you got to tell a teenager, sex is just bad. Like, well, no, never mind. Not that. But maybe you got to tell a teenager, don't have sex right now because you're not ready for it. But they're not going to understand what that really means.
Yeah.
But then when we get into college, you know, you never actually heard the adult conversation about why sex is so good in its right context and so maybe so dangerous outside of that. We never heard the good adult conversation about that. So it's interesting because now I think that's part of what maybe we're hoping to do, and not like we're experts or anything.
And if someone listening had a really positive experience with their parents' upbringing and their school, like absolutely please share that story with us. Send us an email or just post on Facebook. Yeah. We'd love to hear your story. I'm sure that it's there.
Also,
there's
if you had
be...
terrible experiences, I want to hear that.
Yeah.
Like, I just want to hear.
Give us your
best. I want to hear the story about your mom sitting you down and then just giving you a talk.
Oh,
that, like, just was so painful. I want
to
hear
we
that.
Have
give
to
us,
share.
Give us your best bad explanations.
We have to
hold
share
on, Andy,
our story.
Do you have a story?
I'm remembering now, like, a lot of the weird, like lazy examples like that were given to me. Yeah. So I'm remembering like the used car metaphor. Wouldn't you rather buy a brand new car that's never been driven and never been used than a disgusting used car from a dirty used car lot, you know? And like, if you have sex before marriage, that's what you are. You've been used, you know, or like the water bottle example. I think you've seen this one too, Jesse, the water bottle one where there's like two water bottles. One of them the illustration starts off with two totally fine, clean, brand new water bottles. Then, in one of them, like some guy comes on stage I think I saw this at a camp meeting somewhere. Some guy comes on stage and he like opens one of the water bottles and just like drools all over it and spits in it. And then he gives it back to the presenter, and the presenter is holding these two. And then he says, you know, like, which one of these would you rather to marriage as, you know, like the brand new unopened pristine water bottle or like the used slobbered on? This is what you're presenting to your future spouse, basically.
Yikes.
You know?
Well, and the scary part is there's like this weird, and I gotta be careful here, there's this weird sub-level truth to it. Like, you know, wouldn't you rather have like that experience of sex between just the two of you, and there's baggage from the past? There is that.
Right. And there's a beautiful message in there.
Yeah, but then there's like, to not do sex the justice of having a legitimate conversation about why it's so powerful and why, and then to not bring shame and guilt into it like that. Like, I mean, that's horrific.
Yeah.
That's awful.
It's when you think about it, it's like reversed. It's like reactionary, you know, like it's all reactionary language, because if it was proactive, it would be like a proactive stance would be, this is what we believe about sex. And then you just be that. But a reactionary response is like the world around. And I, you know, it's fair, I think, to say that this is how the church responded a lot, as the church looked out at the world and saw like, wow, like, you know, sexual promiscuity is on an all time high, whatever.
Yeah.
And then it just reacted and said, okay, we need to like push back against that. But instead of like creating an alternate stance and being proactive, oftentimes, I think, you know, we've just sort of been reactive and just, you know.
Well, it would seem like if sex is everything that it should be in the context of marriage, shouldn't the positives of what it was created to be outweigh the fear-mongering that needs to be done in order to make you not have it before it's right context?
Yeah, it's like,
I think that's kind of
I think that's what we all miss, too.
Weird to me.
I think
the
thing is, too, like, you know, we can all agree that Satan is use that to create brokenness in the world. Like we all agree that there's so much brokenness, but the thing is the church is acknowledging that brokenness and almost like, instead of focusing on the beauty, they're saying, let's focus on this brokenness and be really scared of it.
Right.
And put up our walls against it instead of instead of putting up walls, what if we instead took the approach of just recapturing the beauty of it, and we wouldn't need to put up the walls. It would fizzle out. You wouldn't have to fear.
You have less of a need to be afraid. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know and to be honest, I'm not accusing anyone or, you know, any specific people that have done that, because I think honestly, it's easier to put up the walls of fear than it is to get back to the beauty, of the intent of God. I think that's much harder.
Well, and there is something to be said about age, right? Like you tell a kid not to cross the street 'cause you might get hit by a car, right? Like there's a fear level to that. You know, but then someday you hope they understand the bigger concept that it's not just fear. It's like you want to have a full and healthy life. You don't want to purposely or unknowingly do something that might hurt you.
Right.
You know, And so hopefully they understand that concept later, but you have to start with fear. But I'm interested in I know both of you guys have done a lot of research biblically about what the Bible says about sex, especially outside of marriage, or why it's supposed to be in marriage. So why don't we move? We have our texting segment. Hmm.
Anytime as a youth pastor, I'm asked, like, can you talk about sex, Pastor Anthony? I'm like, yes, let's 100%, let's do it. So exciting.
That's a little bit weird.
No, I feel like it's not weird though. I feel like,
yes, let's talk about sex. Like that's the level of like excitement.
Well, I mean, as we just stated, like this wasn't something that was talked about thoughtfully for me growing up.
True.
So
yeah.
I love the chance to be able to talk about it thoughtfully with teenagers and to like just sort of dispel all of the weird, like, I don't know, like, what's the word I'm looking for? Presuppositions,
mysterious, and, yeah,
yeah, like his, yeah, I want to say hysteria, but that's not the right word. But yeah, so I think the place where I would always start is with a Hebrew word. It's called echad, and it means one. It means oneness, and that's probably where I would start. Is like, for God's intention of sex, is two different people coming together to form a new thing, and that new thing is called echad, which is this like interplay, like this dance of two different people becoming a new thing.
You can find that word in Genesis 2:24.
Yeah.
It's when, I think, is that where you find it? Or
yeah,
the concept is there.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure
Adam
that is 2:24.
Created,
right?
Yeah, they're Adam and Eve are created, and then it says that the two will leave their father and mother,
right,
and they'll become one flesh.
Right.
And that's that word echad.
So good. So yeah, that's where I would start, and that's what I think is just that basic idea is a countercultural idea that two are becoming one, and this one thing is becoming a new thing, and that sex is a part of that oneness, and it's like the glue that keeps that oneness together. But yeah, that's where I would go. There's plenty of other things to talk about, but
And if you don't mind, I wanna talk about that concept a little bit, the becoming one.
Yeah.
Because there's a level of this that makes sense in the context of marriage as opposed to anywhere else.
Mm.
Because if there is a oneness that's coming from this act, or rather that this act is the culmination,
mm-hmm,
of this commitment to, I'm committing to you.
Mm.
Because that's in essence, Anthony, you wrote this. I don't know if you had read this somewhere or something like that.
Yeah.
But I ended up speaking at a week of prayer and going off of some stuff that you had written about it. And I love this concept that when you are committing to someone, you're saying, I'm committing to all of you, right? Every bit of you, your good stuff, your bad stuff, the insecurities, the strengths, all of that, I'm committing to all of you.
Mm.
And sex is the ultimate level of that, where you are fully naked and exposed. And I mean that, like, not just physically naked though, but emotionally and
spiritually,
and
every layer,
and spiritually,
yeah.
You're kind of stripped bare, and there's this level of, will you accept me like this?
Wow. Yeah.
And so for both of you to be in that state and then to come together and then to have this physical act that you said this earlier is in essence the glue,
yeah,
that brings you into that sense of oneness. But the problem is that you can't become one if you haven't committed to every part of somebody.
Right. Right.
Because then what you're saying is like, I'm committed to all of this part of you, to like these four things, but then there's these two things that I'm not ready to commit to. And yet this action has in essence stated, I'm ready to become one with you.
Right.
Even though I wasn't quite sure if I was actually ready to become one with you.
Yes.
So that seems to be the part that I totally missed, if it was ever talked about in high school or even in college.
Yeah, yeah.
But then now today, it's meaning so much more. This echad, this two different people become an individual almost,
yeah,
or an entity in and of themselves. And that sex is the culmination of that.
Yeah, yeah.
Commitment.
And I feel like I would go two places. I would say, I mean, one, this oneness and this echad is good. It's good. It's not gross,
yeah,
or dirty or bad, but it's actually good and beautiful and amazing. And I think that's the first place. That's usually what I talk about first when talking to high schoolers is just like, we have this idea somehow that like sex is dirty or bad or gross, But in reality, it's like God made it, and God wanted to make it, and it's something that's good and awesome. And I always describe it as good but dangerous, because we live in a broken world. All of the best things that God has created are now dangerous to us because we tend to worship them. I would say that. But then the second thing is that, like what you were saying, Jesse, in the commitment confines of marriage. Confines is an interesting word. We could have to talk more about that. In the commitment of marriage, I truly believe that sex is the most, like, closest picture to what God's love is like, which is kind of like the statement, I see all of you and I still love you. I see everything and I still love you. And in fact, I want every part of you. And I think that part that you said, Jesse, which I guess you were quoting me, so I guess I'm quoting myself. I guess this is a roundabout self-promotional.
The guy is quoting you as your quote.
Oh, my perfect word. But yeah, I think, like, the idea that, like, because I was, we were all, I'll speak for myself, that I was given these, like, cheap illustrations of what sex before marriage does, you know, like the water bottle and the used car. I was never able to get to the deeper level, which is that, and this I think is a worldview breakdown between a biblical worldview and like a postmodern worldview, or like the worldview of the world and our culture. I think this is where it breaks down, which is the idea that sex inherently means commitment. Because I think if you ask any, you know, non-religious person, you know, does sex mean commitment? I think most people, especially our age, would say, no, not really. You can have sex. It doesn't really, you know, like, it, maybe that's something you do on the first or second date, you know. But
crazy. I was, when I was doing this week of prayer, I ended up sitting in the Bible classes with some of these kids.
Yeah.
And this one guy, I appreciate his honesty. Honestly, he was a senior. And he says, honestly, I get all of that, but I still think that sex is just something you can do.
Mm.
Like, you can just have it and it's fine. There's not a ton of other stuff to it. So it's not like what you're saying is, there is a quite different idea.
Yeah.
Of what sex actually is.
100%. I think that's totally where our culture disconnects with the biblical worldview, which is that God created sex to inherently create commitment. Like, when you do it, it makes commitment.
You even see that in, like, movies.
Yeah.
Right? Where you, like Friends with Benefits, and then at the end of it,
they fall,
like,
in love.
They're romantically involved because they realize that they were all, that. But you know what's crazy is, like, that's almost an opposing
the
worldview.
The antithesis of.
Yeah, but it's affirming the biblical worldview.
Yeah, it's a weird reverse commentary. Yeah, that's true. So yeah, there's lots more that could be said, but I love that part that I believe the biblical worldview, what I believe it's saying is that sex is saying, when you have it with someone, I want all of you, not only just your body, but your past, your future, your dreams, your hopes.
Can I quote you on this? Yeah. I literally have what you wrote down. Oh, really? And then Sean, I want to ask you about some of the stuff you've done. But what you wrote, Anthony, was sex is the confirmation of a commitment. It's an act that literally does say, I am committing to all of you, to your body, your personality, your past, your present, your future, your dreams, your mistakes, your good, your bad, and to tomorrow.
Wow.
With you, you know, and that's a powerful statement that, you know, that's what sex really comes down to.
Well, I'm a powerful thinker and powerful.
Yes, you are. Absolutely. you are the C.S. Lewis of this generation.
I feel so, my ego is so boosted right now in this episode. This is great.
I'm so glad, Anthony.
We need to move to Sean before I become a maniac.
Just a shining beacon of pride.
Yeah.
So Anthony, Sean, let me tell you why everything you just said, including the quote, is all wrong.
Oh. Oh, bring it back down.
No.
Sean, in that
wow, I'm sorry. I was ready for that challenge. Now I'm excited, but no, I'm kidding.
No, Sean, I'm curious, in that context of what we're talking about, where echad, or like this coming together as one, you know, you've done more research into some of the other stuff in scripture that it says. What are you seeing?
Yeah, I mean, you guys focused on the positive, and I know we said before, like, we want to focus on the positive of sex and why God created it and the purpose. But honestly,
I'm sensing a but. I'm sensing a huge, like, massive
there's
a butt.
Yeah, there's a big butt. Big butt.
Big butts, and we cannot lie.
Nemo wants to touch this butt. So the reality.
Wow. Going back in the references. Okay.
That's ancient.
Here's the reality, yeah, though, is our church, and again, this is actually not just an Adventist issue. Probably out of all the things we've spoken about, this is a larger Christian topic. There's not many exclusive Adventist teachings on sex that are different, again, that are different than the larger Christian body. In fact, as I looked up, you know, normally we want to kind of look at our church roots on stances on sex, but pretty much they lined up with other Christian movements throughout the 19th, 20th, and 21st century. Like it's all similar. So, but the thing is, with all of those, the challenge is it's almost always when sex is brought up, you talk about the negatives. And so that's where this kind of idea that the Christian church is judgmental or it's not fun. Oh, you don't want us to have sex and party and enjoy these things, right? That's where the conclusion is. When generally people in the church, if you listen to them long enough, a defense I've heard very often is no. People inside marriage and in a committed relationship, they're having more sex and the sex is better. And I hear statistics on those things. In my head,
we'll talk about that in a second.
And in my head, I almost think in the back of my head, like, well, why don't we talk about that more? But anyways, the reality is when I looked in the Bible, I had a very interesting experience with that. And again, for those listening, if you hear something that you're like, oh, they missed that or Sean missed this, then share that with me, please. But I went through,
please, if you sense that Sean missed anything, like if you sense he got it wrong, if you sense that, then please tell us
so we can berate
him. To hear that. Just specifically Sean.
Yeah, please do. So the point is this, as I went through scripture, I was looking for what the scripture has to talk about when we look at sex. I was specifically thinking about our topic today, which is sex before marriage. The concept of fornication, it's kind of an old timey word used for sex outside of a marriage context, specifically like before marriage, like you're not married. You're having sex with someone else that's not married. It's different from adultery. Adultery is where there is someone that is maritally involved and breaking that vow through that. That's adultery. But with fornication, I was trying to look up, are there any explicit teachings in the Bible that talk about fornication? And as I went through, I had a really hard time finding any passages that explicitly teach that you should not have sex with someone else if you're not married. Now again, I want to be careful how I say that. I'm not saying that the Bible...
Yeah, because you just said something huge.
Right, yeah, so I'm not...
Huge.
Again, now don't change the structure here. What I'm not saying, I'm not saying that the Bible condones it. It's not like the Bible says, oh yeah, you can have sex wherever. But when it comes to explicitly stating, oh yeah, you can't have sex outside of marriage, it doesn't explicitly state that. Now I would argue that in principle, you'd have a very hard time.
Because are you kind of arguing that based on the fact that like it doesn't say don't have sex before you're married, but it does say don't be sexually immoral. Don't have sex.
So you get
in essence, don't fornicate. Don't like that people who are fornicators. I hate that word.
Yeah,
that
word
is one of the worst
it's
words.
Just a weird, ambiguous,
I hate even using
word.
It. I feel old.
Yeah, but here's what's interesting.
Like,
as I looked up all the translations of the word porneia, which is
the Greek word
that's used for sexual immorality, it has synonyms like fornication. But fornication, I'm not sure that that's equal to sexual immorality. Now I know that we equate it as such, but I cannot find a passage in the Bible, at least in my read through, that specifically the word porneia can be appropriately used in the context as fornication, like sex between two consensual adults or two consensual people that are...
Did you say consensual?
I totally did.
Consensual.
Okay,
words.
So the closest... Here's the thing. You can go through the Bible. It talks about non-consensual, like rape and other forms of perversities, right? Those are obviously wrong. We don't need to talk about those. It speaks... So that's... If anyone wants to look it up, look up Genesis 34, 1 through 7. The Bible talks about seducing. Seducing is wrong. Seducing someone into a relationship for sexual purposes.
This was especially outside the context of marriage, though. This was like a man seducing a woman.
Yes.
Into having sex before they were married, or like maybe they were engaged to be married, but they weren't married yet.
Right, and they're using power to get sex. Right. Exodus. It's not it's still on the lines of not consensual. Okay. You're using some sort of leverage to get sex. It's coercive. Yeah. So Exodus 22, 16 and 17, if you want to look up what it says on seducing. Then when it comes to actual consensual sex, really in the Old Testament first, you see a lot of the punishing of consensual sex go against the woman. So if you don't have, again, if you are not a virgin, women are punished for that. If a man finds out that that's the case, right? But again, this is in the context of a man that wants to get married to her, and then there's the whole process for that. But again, as I went through, including the New Testament, and I looked up some articles, I looked at what people had to say about fornication. The most common passage that they look at is 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 2 through 5. 1 Corinthians 7, 2 through 5. And as I look at even that, and I go through that, I have a really hard time completely being convinced that that passage is talking about fornication.
When you say that, you mean consensual sex between two adults that are not married, like
correct.
In a modern context.
Or even pledged to be married or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
That passage, by the way, that Paul uses, basically it's saying that if you have troubles of lust and and you're inflamed with passion, you should get married so that you can control that.
That's Paul, who is this staunchly single man, saying like, I don't need to get married because I'm fine. But he's like, but if you can't
control yourself
having sex, then you should probably
should
get married.
Right. And I see what he's saying there. Right. But the thing is, people will use that. And I was reading some that said this clearly states that fornication is wrong, that sex before marriage is wrong. And the thing is, I feel that that's a bit of jumping to a conclusion. There's still, for me at least, a gap. There's a gap there that I'm not quite resolving there. Because again, we're talking about lust, and you could almost make a case that in a committed relationship, that you're not talking necessarily about lust when we're talking about sexual intimacy, but that's another whole area.
Actually,
that, like that's a really challenging, that's a really challenging discussion actually.
Yeah, that's good.
So it's interesting because what I don't hear you saying is that that the Bible isn't saying, sex can be had anywhere. What I do hear you saying is that we have in essence explained it as the Bible says literally word for word, don't have sex, you know, before marriage.
Yeah. It's not that simple. Now again,
it doesn't say that specifically.
Right. And I want to be careful because I don't think it supports. I want to be really clear on my conclusion is I don't think it necessarily supports the idea of fornication. I don't think it supports that anywhere, but to simply say that the Bible gives a clear definition of why fornication is bad and that it should be avoided at all costs and it's sinful, that is a bit of a stretch. I do want to point that out, but
which is challenging because I think many of us were brought up with the notion, or at least it was kind of portrayed to us, that the Bible had a really black and white clear stance on the sex before marriage is clearly wrong. You know, almost.
I'm going to be honest. Like even right now, you saying this is messing with my like. But no. Wait. Hold on.
Oh, you feel resistance
that.
In your heart right now.
Yeah. No. Even though I think I understand what you're saying, there's part of me that's like, wait, no. Hold on. But I'm even looking up the verses right now that you've mentioned in our outline, and I'm looking at them like, yeah. Like this one says, "For this is the will of God, your sanctification, that you abstain from sexual immorality." But it's not really explicitly stating what that means.
There's no list of
as
actions.
Much as it's like that this specific action would be sexually immoral, and this one too, and this one too, and this one too.
Right.
But that the general
there
concept
are
of
there are
morality.
Lists given of sexually immoral things, but fornication is not included on them. That's my point. Mm-hmm. So, and that's a whole other ball game because there's things on that list that could be whole other discussions, right?
Yeah.
But my point again. Yeah, as we look through it, it's not as clear as at least I'd like it to be. And so I think in principle, we have to go back on what the Bible talks about when it comes to sex and when you look at throughout Scripture. I do personally think there is a case principle-wise when you look at the themes of Scripture that sex was designed to be within a marriage structure.
For sure, yeah.
I think logically that's just what it is. But I think our rhetoric needs to change because here's the strange thing. Fornication is a word I've heard and it seems like a very biblical word, but I can't find in Scripture where fornication is used. And right. and maybe someone more intimately involved with porneia and the Greek and Hebrew could help me with that, because I just could not find an example. I've seen sexual immorality branch out to mean different things like fornication, but I right. can't find a biblical passage where that word fornication should be used.
Would be the only using of that.
Yes,
word,
in yes. That's
instead of it being translated generally as sexually immoral, that it could in essence say in our English, in a better English, not our old English, that where you would only translate the word porneia as don't have sex outside of the context of
yeah,
marriage.
Yeah, right. That's what I want to know.
I think that's where
and that's interesting. Yeah,
and that's where it's challenging, because so I did a little digging into porneia, into the word, the other night, and it's so. What's interesting is, I mean, if you want to look this up, in Strong's Concordance, it's a number 4202, just for a little reference there.
Great, yeah.
But,
for all of the theologians.
For all the theologians here.
What?
I'm sure there are people who are down with being a theologian. But what's interesting about the word is, from all of my digging, like, and from all my reading of people way smarter than me, way smarter than us, you know, scholars, like, it's, I think the conclusion is the same that you came to, Sean, that it's just unclear. That like it means literally to act the harlot, or AKA indulge in unlawful sexual practice.
Yeah, that's what I saw too.
But the problem is there's no specific definition or list of things that are unlawful sexual practices. Like we do have a few things, but they're
not a comprehensive.
It's not a comprehensive list. And the category that we use today, which is consensual sex between two consenting adults who are unmarried, it wasn't even really a category in that culture and time period, right? Which is a whole nother conversation, you know, because you mostly had arranged marriages, or you're having sex with a temple prostitute, or, you know, or something like that. But like the idea of two consenting adults who are unmarried, who live together and have sex, that's a very like, you know, post 20th century idea.
Why don't we actually talk about this? This
oh, is Jesse's, interesting to are me. Are we going to transition
moving out of our texting segment into this just kind of discussion? I think this is interesting because when we look at modern ideas of marriage, it's so dramatically different. So there's this idea that we've had of you're supposed to wait until marriage, but in America, just in America, a century ago, about 11% of women were sexually active before marriage. 11%, right? And now today, there's not a specific number, but it's a large majority, right? So that's above 50%, like a large enough majority that it would be far above 50% in essence.
I found the same numbers,
Yeah, that's a dramatically different thing. I saw another, and I cannot
stress enough.
Quantify this right now. I can't reference it right now, but I remember seeing a study, and so take this with a grain of salt, but I remember seeing a study that 91% of people that come to the altar, at least one of the people that's at the altar has had sex before. So 91% of marriages
coming to the altar, you mean getting married, right?
Getting married, yeah. Sorry, that 91% of people are not going into marriage with both parties being virgins, which is, I mean, like, weirdly, I'm not surprised, and yet the number is just kind of like, oh wow, I didn't realize it was that much. And which is crazy, because if you're saying 91%, I mean, think about how many people in America subscribe to Christianity, right? And so maybe a large portion of that 9% of marriages that are both virgins, maybe a large portion of that are Christians, but that means that the vast majority of Christians are not virgins showing up at the altar, which is a completely different concept. And I think for a number of reasons, one of which is that we put off marriage for a long time. You hit puberty, you know, somewhere 12 to 17, right? Somewhere in that age group.
Right.
And on average, and in Bible times, you're getting married. Maybe if you're a girl, you're getting married in your teens for sure. If you're a guy, maybe in your 20s, sometimes later on, but generally young, you know, like late teens, early 20s. You know, so you're staving off the trappings of sexual temptation for what? Maybe 4 years, maybe at the most seven, you know, on average, right? Today, people are waiting until they're like 30 to get married.
Right.
You know,
it's only getting
so
older.
That means that, like, on if you hit puberty when you're 12 and you don't get married till you're 30, that's 18 years.
That's huge, yeah.
Of having a sex drive that is strong
and natural and normal.
What do you do with that? Yeah, and there's different reasons too. There's economic reasons. There is just the kind of the more individualistic idea of our society. Different, like when you see all of your parents get divorced, you know, you don't want to get married until you find the right person. There's so many different reasons for it. And so that I think is a thing that is just completely different today, that even though I got married at, oh man, how old was I? I think I was 22. You know, that's still almost a decade of having a sex drive, you know? And then there's some people who don't get married into their 30s. And so it's like, dang, you know, that changes a conversation about sex. It just does. Whether we want to acknowledge that as Christians or not, it just does change the conversation.
Mm-hmm. And I think to follow up with what you're saying, when you were looking up stuff, did you find the Fog Zone study?
No.
Does that sound familiar? So I found this study called the Fog Zone. It's done in 2009, so almost a decade ago at this point. It is a decade. We're in 2019.
Yeah, 2019.
Today. Oh, my word. That's crazy.
2009 was 10 years ago.
Wow. We graduated in 2010, so that's weird. That's crazy. It's almost our 10-year, guys. Wow.
Dang.
But yeah, so this study, there's a whole relevant article about it, but they're basically what they found was that they were studying the difference between evangelicals who have gotten married, who have had sex, and non-religious people. And they found that 80% of unmarried evangelical young adults, so this is the ages 18 to 29, said that they had had sex. 80% of unmarried evangelical young adults. And the statistic for non-religious young adults, same age, is 88%.
So we're like, so it's, you know, evangelical Christians are only 8% behind.
It's only 8% behind.
So can I use that? Anthony, let me use that for a second. If we have those statistics there, I want you to picture now, as Jesse brought the idea of, I don't know if it was camp meeting. Think of the camp meeting setting where a presenter goes up with the water bottle.
Right.
Dang.
And you spit in the water bottle, and 80% of the people watching, this is just a guilt trip for them.
Yeah. Everyone's like, everyone's thinking about what they did.
Oh man. So, that's something exactly.
So again, the whole point of this is we need to accept the reality of what we're working with. We can all agree that life would be simpler if, you know, we already said this, life would be simpler if there was more committed relationships and it was always within the context of marriage. But if these numbers are true, and say there's always going to be the cynical side of me that says, oh, this is only one study, whatever, yada, yada, yada.
Right.
But there's very little doubt in my mind that this is reality. When you look around, this is reality. There's most people, and I would say maybe even argue that most Christians, that is, it's not much different. There's plenty of Christians living together, having sex, and it's before marriage. It's outside of a marriage context. So with that being said, even if the numbers are smaller, whatever it may be, the principle is still, we need to change the way we talk about it, because that analogy of the bottle, as much as you can say and argue, sure, yeah, it'd be better to have the new bottle. Who are you speaking to?
Right.
Yeah.
Who's that?
And you're speaking to such a small amount of people in that room. Yeah.
Because I understand that there's a need when you're preaching or giving a talk or you're with a close friend, there's a need to convict, right? And there's there's the idea of the Holy Spirit convicting our hearts and leading us to a better life. But I think there's something to be said about doing that in a way that's positive. You show the joy and love, and it causes you to look inward and say, oh, there is brokenness in me. You don't necessarily need it to be explicitly said. Yeah. You're broken. You're a damaged water bottle.
Right.
Instead, it's always better. And I've found that in my life, the sermons where I come to the conclusion that I need to change something is the best sermon. It's not the one where it's explicitly stated, you should do this, not that.
Where the Spirit's convicting you as opposed to just saying like, oh yeah, you're a terrible person, or you're dirty and messed up if you've had sex before.
Yeah.
Right. Right. So
I think it's interesting though, because like, Sean, I'm so glad you brought it up. I think we need to talk about that reality, because when you brought that up, like, 80% of the people in the room, this is just a guilt trip, you know, it actually creates an issue for me as a pastor, because I have heard, especially, like, I would think I was watching a sermon by Carl Lentz. He's the pastor of Hillsong New York, And great, seems like a great pastor. I saw this sermon by him, and he was talking about, you know, purity, in essence, from a very traditional evangelical standpoint. Oh, wow. And I was, I was weirdly surprised. I don't know why I was so surprised, but just, it was very traditional. It was, you know, be pure, don't, you know, we went on, I don't remember exactly what it was, but along the lines of, like, you know, didn't have any sort of sexual contact before marriage. And I was surprised by that, because I'm sitting there like, okay, this is a great ideal, right? Like, I want to reach to level 100, you know? But the reality is that what do you do when you have people who love Jesus so much and are so close to Jesus, and yet they're in a relationship where they are so drawn to each other, you know, and sexuality is just a reality in their relationship,
but
they are so in love with Jesus, and it's a point of guilt and shame for them, but they're still sexually active because it's a powerful thing. So what do you do with that? And and it's interesting, because it creates a problem for me as a pastor, because I don't want to stand up there and then and preach the ideal, knowing that, like, what, I'm not actually making a difference here. You know, that's what it, and maybe this is just my opinion, but, like, that's what it feels like. I'm just going to be preaching this ideal, setting this standard for people, saying, good luck, you know, be pure before you're married. And I know that most people haven't. You know, and so it's like, what do you do with that? Like, do you keep preaching the ideal, but then say, ah, but, you know, if you haven't, Jesus still loves you? Because that feels wrong, too. That's like, Jesus still loves you if you've had sex. It's like,
which is true. It's a true statement.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. But, like, it feels almost condescending.
It's the same.
Like,
it's the same with, I'm praying for you, right? Because it sounds beautiful, right? It sounds beautiful to say, I'm praying for you, but it's.
It's not of actual value.
We've all heard that phrase where at best it doesn't have value.
Helpful.
At best it doesn't have value. At worst it's condescending.
Yeah.
So it's similar in that way.
Yeah.
Well, can I talk about this? I actually want to talk about, weirdly enough, the destructive parts of sex that I've seen.
Yeah, yeah.
So for instance, I did this week of prayer at this high school over this kind of out in the Midwest, and after I talked about sex, it was all about relationships. The third day was sex. You know, it was like the second week of school too.
Oh, wow.
So a bunch of freshmen had just come into school.
Oh, wow.
And they're like, I just imagine, it looked like they were deer in the headlights.
Yeah.
Just like, what is happening?
What is this?
What is high school?
High school is intense, man.
About sex. But I was talking about it, and this girl wanted to talk to me after, and she expressed to me, she was, oh man, I want to say she was a sophomore or a junior. And she expressed to me that when she was, like, young, like 13, 14, her boyfriend at the time, who was similar in age, convinced her to have sex. And after that, he broke. It wasn't long. It was the 13, 14-year-old relationship.
Classic.
Like, they didn't stay together for very long. And she ended up, she had now come to this point where she felt like if she didn't have sex with people, like with guys, they wouldn't love her. They wouldn't find her valuable. They wouldn't find her as something that she... And so here she is weeping in front of me because she feels trapped into giving away her sexuality for the hope of being loved and cared for by a boy. But not even a man who she's married to, a boy who doesn't even know what he wants. That's what she felt pressured into. And so... you know, God took it away, and the words were, I was just like, you don't have to do a thing to earn God's love, and so you don't have to do a thing to earn His. You know, to this other boy, you don't have to. That was in essence what I was saying, and it was apparently the first time she'd heard, like, the gospel.
Wow.
You know, just like, you can't do anything to earn God's love, so you don't have to. You know, and He loves you anyway, so you don't have to earn love from this other boy.
Wow.
But she had been destroyed by this concept that she was now trapped in this, that she felt like she had to have sex. There was another girl who I knew. She called me one day talking about how she had been dating this guy for a year, and he had told all of his friends of their sexual exploits. And so after they broke up, all of his friends just saw her as a sexual object. This guy came over to her house one time. This guy she barely knew.
Ugh.
Came over to her house. He had toiletries with him.
Like he was planning to stay the night.
Toothpaste. He was expecting to stay the night just by showing up at the door.
Jeez.
You know, this is who she was now. You know, I've seen this damage. There's a young couple that I know now, and they live together, and they are two of the greatest people I know. But they're probably far too, air quotes, in love to really have a mature relationship. And what I mean by that is they're sexually active, and so I think that they have these rose-colored glasses on to the max because they're not really seeing, I think, the realities of relationship. Not that they should break up, but just that I think that they want to get married quickly, and the problem is that they're going into it not really having, I think, addressed the whole of their relationship because they're sexually active. So this is some of the stuff that I've seen, and this is just probably touching the surface of some of the stories that and I'm sure you guys have stories too. So this is not simple. I don't think that I can honestly ever say that sex outside of the context of marriage is a good thing. But then I have this problem.
Right, the tension.
I've seen, well, no, but then I've seen, all three of us know a couple that they live together now. They're about to get married. They're, you know, 3 or 4 months out. And I know they're sexually active. And they have a great relationship.
Right.
And I'm like, so what am I supposed to tell them?
Right,
you know,
right,
like,
yeah.
What am I supposed to say? Stop having sex, move out. You know, like, what do you do in that context? You know, there's these gray areas that become a huge issue. And I don't know what to do with it. I'm just, I'm being completely honest as a pastor. I don't know what to do.
And I think that brings up the extremely complicated area within this topic of engagement, and especially because, like, and I remember feeling as an engaged person, like, this is real weird because I said the words, will you marry me? She said yes. You know, like, we've made this commitment and, like, we're going to get married. It's only a matter of time, you know? And so feeling this pressure and this very natural, like, I'm in love with this woman. She's in love with me. God made this and he made this attraction. Like, this attraction isn't something that's a result of sin or something evil or bad or wrong. Like, this attraction to want to be physically active sexually is a thing God made and it's good.
Yeah.
You know, and so there's always this feeling. And I remember at a certain point, us, like our whole friend group, like we didn't.
The
Jesse, Sean, Anthony fan group.
We have about
thousands of followers,
millions around the world. No, I remember our friend group because we were all dating and engaged around the exact same time. And I remember all of us coming together and having, like, finally talking, like, after being engaged for a while, and all of us saying, like, oh man, like, we all feel the same tension. Like we all feel the same temptation. We all feel the same, like, man, this isn't really talked about. This is like, we were never really told how to manage this, you know, like the fact that, like, we're going to get married, but we also feel this tension, you know? So
Sorry, Anthony. The only thing I've heard on it and we don't really talk about it a lot. And the only thing I've heard is stories that people give in response to that is, well, people break off engagements. You see people break off engagements.
Right.
So,
exactly. That's
so be careful. Cause, and we had a teacher in high school that had this crazy story of actually breaking off his current wife. And I say current wife, his only wife. They've been married for years and, you know, whatever, it's great. But he broke off his wife's engagement with another man.
Oh, I totally forgot about that.
Like,
So, like, and when I say that, the story, I mean, more of the story is like she left her fiance for him. And so it's kind of like that. And there's stories like that where people say,
if they had been sexually active, you know, like, just because they were engaged.
Yeah. Like, imagine all the baggage that would come with that. Right. Well, so it's like, that's the story that's given. Here's my response to that though, is you can use the same argument for marriage.
Yeah,
right. You could always get it.
Because, oh man, this is a problem because, like, when we have generationally seen so many marriages implode,
right.
You know, how many people are like, "Oh, marriage is safe," you
right?
Know?
Especially,
like,
in the church,
we've seen marriages implode all the time, and so it's like all of a sudden you realize that's not much safer. And I need to be careful here because I'm happily married. I love my wife, but I want to be careful because I think I fully understand the fear of, like, well, yeah, I don't want to have sex till I'm married, but that's not safer. In fact, it's crazy. Marriage is almost more dangerous because if your wife were to leave you, it would hurt even more than if your girlfriend left you.
Right. And when you look at the statistics, you know, the 50% statistic in and outside of the church, you know, it's so I think it's a very real fear.
Yeah. So Sean, sorry, I cut you off. But
no,
like,
I mean,
yeah
it's just, I think
point.
It's, I think at that point it's just semantics to argue that,
yeah.
That, oh, you really have to be careful. Cause if that happened, what would happen? Sure. That's one very small scenario. And yes, yeah. we know people that have broke off engagements and whatever, but it's the same reaction you have when someone breaks off a marriage, right? Because right. there's that there, the commitment's been established, right? They've both agreed to this commitment.
Yeah.
So sure, neither one is ideal. Both are in a, yeah. it's both the result of brokenness and sin in this world. But again, we're not, the problem is when we are in church or when we're talking with people, people feel like church is no longer real because we're always speaking to the ideal and not the reality.
Oh, yeah. So good, Sean.
And so if we're not,
but see, okay,
if we're not
so
speaking,
I have an opinion about that.
So yeah, good.
I have an opinion
yeah,
about
go
that.
Go for it.
We should, let's move the opinion zone, actually.
Ooh.
I want to talk about this.
Is it opinion zone time?
This is our opinion zone time.
Here we go. Welcome to the opinion zone. We'll do it with my better
mind. Here's my opinion, okay?
What's your opinion?
In spite of everything we're saying, I firmly believe that we need to continue to set out the ideal. And this is so weird for me to say right now. I think we have to, because I think to water down, oh man, I don't even know if I believe this, but I also believe this, that I think to water down the ideal.
Yeah.
Is to, in essence, say, continue doing unhealthy things, and that's not any better. But I'm being real here. I don't know if this is the best option, but I just know that to water down the ideal and then to say, yeah, you know, honestly, like, I can't honestly say don't have sex before marriage because I know 80% of you are already doing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like to then say, oh yeah, I guess that's fine then. Doesn't really do what sex is justice. When we talked at the beginning about how powerful sex is, where it's this coming together of one, like, we have to acknowledge that that is no light thing, right? That is incredibly powerful. So I'm saying this as my opinion, but also I don't know if I believe everything about it. But at the same time, like, we can't water it down. We can't water scripture down, because I think why you're right, Sean, that it does say, it doesn't explicitly say some of this stuff. The concept is very clear that that marriage and sex go together, that sex outside of marriage is almost always a destructive thing in scripture, at least
portrayed as that,
right?
Yeah.
Like, you look at a bunch of the stories, especially in the Old Testament, it's almost always destructive. And so, like, that to me says we have to continue this concept of sex and marriage are what is God intended, right?
Yeah,
it's the gold standard.
So not hold up that idea. Yeah, so that's my opinion. We have to continue to hold up the ideal, but I'm also struggling with holding.
So I think there's a difference between holding the ideal and knowing the right thing to say to people with questions. So again, if the whole thing is we have bad explanations for a great ideal, we don't need to change the ideal. I don't think we really need to change that to change our explanation.
At least not this one. Yeah.
We
in essence, we don't have to change our belief. We have to change the way we explain our belief. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think we need to change the way we explain, the way we carry out it. And I think it's so challenging because we grew up in the same church where we had the same problem. So it's almost like blind leading the blind. So we have to really, for us to get out
which
of that.
I hear that blindness is a side effect of self pleasure.
Oh, so, man.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I
was also taught that masturbation would lead to blindness. Yeah. What was that?
Is that
a Kellogg quote? A John Harvey Kellogg?
I don't even know.
I think that is.
A whole other. Oh, well.
Sorry,
back
I had
then,
to bring that up just because it's like that's another bad explanation.
Well, back then, I don't know about the blindness. Well, yeah, actually, the blindness was there, but they actually believed it made you go insane, too. But the thing is,
Sean said it so matter of fact.
But that was a common teaching medically too. It wasn't just in our church. Now Ellen, I think Ellen White adopted that.
Yeah.
But it was actually taught medically too. But that was,
and isn't that terrible? Like, you see, you go to an insane asylum, you're like, oh my goodness, yeah. Oh my goodness, how many of these people got here because of that?
That's
like, that's a terrible thing to
that's
think.
That's the reason.
Check their knuckles.
Sorry, we totally.
Oh my
we
word!
You get hairy. Yeah, get hairy, like hairy hands, right?
Yeah.
Sorry. Anyways, we just went off on a horrible tangent. Sean, you were saying that it's like the blind leading the blind because right. We, in essence, we went through the same bad explanations. So now what do we do?
It just compounds.
Yeah, we absolutely need to have more conversations in the open about it. I think that's where it starts, because here's the thing. All three of us, I mean, sorry, spoiler alert, I don't think we have a perfect answer for how to remedy this. But True. But the reality is we need to have more conversations in the open. We need to create an atmosphere in our church that we're safe to talk about it.
Mm.
Yeah.
Where we're not afraid for, I don't know, for our employment or for our status in our church based on our opinion, mm-hmm. Or our challenge to a certain held belief within our church, right? And that's, I think, something we need to be more open about. And we need to have more dialogue about what is healthy. We need to have a conversation about what healthy conversation is.
Ooh.
Like, our church is at a point, we're not having so healthy conversation in so many areas. In fact, I think this podcast exists because our church fails to have healthy conversations.
100%.
Yeah.
On a whole,
totally agree.
This podcast exists for that purpose. So if we're looking at sex, we can't even start with saying we need to have healthy conversations. We need to have a conversation about how to have healthy conversations.
Mm-hmm. Well, so now I'm going to totally go against the last part of what you just said and ask you, because I totally agree with you, Sean. We absolutely need to have that. But for the sake of our episode today, I want to ask, how could we talk about sex in a healthy way now? So, Sean, you would come up with a great idea of, you know, say this, not that, you know. So, like, if we were to say to somebody who was asking, well, what do I say about sex, you know, and we said, say this, not that, what would you say?
Careful, Sean.
Really,
this is hard. This is a recording of you saying this for all of eternity.
I know.
We're gonna show this to your son,
your newborn
someday.
Son, right after his birth. He'll listen to it.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yes,
and hopefully he'll be fully indoctrinated.
Yes, so. Absolutely. I'm trying to think of all the different scenarios. I mean, honestly, if someone
just
is asking,
one.
Yeah,
just
yeah.
Give us
so
a basic,
right, the
basic
big
scenario,
the big question, right, is the one we've had bad explanations on is. Why can't I have sex before marriage?
Mm-hmm.
And I would probably start focusing on what we've already talked about at the beginning is I would say sex is a beautiful thing that God created for us. It wasn't meant to be awkward. It wasn't meant to be taboo. But it also wasn't meant to be broken. And there are many examples of brokenness in this world. And instead of focusing on all the details and the fear-mongering, I would focus more on the beauty that we said that we didn't get in our childhood. And and here's the thing, it's going to be awkward. No matter what you do, if you talk about the fearful parts, it's going to be awkward with a junior high kid. It's also going to be awkward to say that sex is beautiful. I remember when pastors did say things like that, even though it was few and far in between, I remember there were a couple of sermons in my life that I heard some charismatic pastors say, sex is beautiful, I love it with my wife, and go into it, and I'd be all like snickering in the back with friends and stuff. But here's the thing, I'd rather have that uncomfortable conversation and say sex is beautiful, God created it, it's an amazing thing that actually draws closer to him and to someone else in this world, and focus on that. I would rather say that than say, oh, look at all the STDs in the world. Look at how painful it is, and you're stuck with it for life. And imagine you're a water bottle that's broken, you know, and been
so rough.
Slobbery, dirty water bottle. You.
So I know that that doesn't fully remedy it. I know that doesn't answer everything, but I would start with that. I would say, you know, look at the beautiful before you look at the ugly.
Mm.
Anthony, what would you say?
Oh, man. Well... Yeah, I think I would just say, and I have said this before, my favorite thing to say when I'm invited into like Bible class to talk to the seniors or whatever is to say that I don't really believe in or like saying that don't have sex before marriage because it's a sin and it's breaking like a rule that God made. Because as we've already discussed in this podcast, it's quite a bit of a gray area that, you know, we're not going to find a commandment that says thou shalt not have sex before marriage. and in that black and white way, right?
Maybe we could find conceptually, but you're not going to find a statement on
it. Right, we're not going to find a statement that says that, right. So I like to, if I'm giving my framework, and something that I would say and have said to young people, it would be that sex is less of a, like, before marriage is less breaking a rule, and more that when you have sex, God considers you married. So if you're having sex with someone and you don't follow through with all the other levels of commitment that the act of sex inherently communicates, you cause pain and destruction for yourself and for others. Because sex was created to be glue that creates commitment, that it almost like pees out commitment. That's a little bit of a crude metaphor. It's sort of just, expunges commitment.
There were so many other phrases you could
have used. I'm so sorry. It's just this topic. It has me in the bathroom humor. I'm trying to resist it, but I'm secretly 12 forever. Because sex was created by God to be the glue that creates commitment with a person, when you give that glue to someone you're not committed to, it actually, you cause yourself pain and damage, and it actually leads to less joy. And that's what I would always say, and that's what I would come to in conclusion, is that simply sex before marriage leads to less joy than sex within commitment. Yeah. And that's why God created it to be that way. Because if you believe that God created everything that he creates and like principles that we find in the Bible, it's all for our flourishing and for our joy and for our shalom and for our peace. And so like God doesn't make things up just to be like create rules and regulations and to prevent fun. But in fact, we find that restrictions in this area actually enhance and create more joy. So that's what I would say is,
I want to mention too, really, I just want to mention too, really quick, what you mentioned a really good point there, which is that God creates rules or the things he sets up is to bring more joy or more intimacy or more closeness with God.
Yeah.
And again, you can go through the Bible. That's actually true all throughout. There are people that try to speak against, especially the Old Testament, the Levitical laws. But there's actually a lot of beauty there when you see that God set those up to be more intimate with Israel. And you actually see progression from the end of, or I believe it was at the start of Leviticus to the end or the beginning of Numbers. And as you get to Deuteronomy, you actually see the progression Israel has. There's a certain point where they're outside the tent. They're not in God's presence, but because of the laws that, God set up, they actually eventually got closer to God when they started following those. They were able to be in his glory. And there's a really profound way of looking at that.
I agree that rules are beautiful, but I do think that focusing on the beauty of the thing of sex specifically is probably our best motivating factor.
100%.
Honestly,
we have to create an ultimate stance.
You can get that, like, oh yeah, this rule is so that I'm safe, but unless it's internalized in your heart, it's not going to make a huge difference. Yeah. I think the crazy thing for me is, if we're talking about sex before marriage, I think the way that I would talk about it is, when you are sexually involved with someone, and I would, this is a little bit of the thing that we probably can't talk more about today just based on time, but I would honestly say that sexual intercourse is different than other acts of other sexual acts.
Oh yeah, we gotta talk more about that sometime.
Yeah, I believe personally that is a different level of sexual intimacy than other things. Not that other things aren't sex, but that is kind of the pinnacle of it. That being said, you know, sex in general, if you're sexually involved before marriage, in essence, especially if you haven't committed to each other, you know, if you haven't stood up before a bunch of people and in front of a bunch of people and said, I am committing to all of you. And you have that level of commitment, you have that level of accountability, you have that understanding that I've committed to you, this is it. If you don't do that, then the door is always open. And reality is I don't want to be naked while the door is open, you know? And so
that's good.
The thing is like, if I'm going to open myself up to you, but you're not committing to every part of me, that means you're leaving the door a crack open. And if there's that possibility that you're going to ditch a sign that you don't like something about me that you haven't committed to,
right,
then me being naked and vulnerable and exposing all of me to you is just opening up this incredible amount of pain that could happen. Mm. And I don't want to do that as a fear-based thing. I don't want to say, oh, look at all the pain that you could experience. But rather that, like, I don't want to open up myself to someone unless they have fully committed to me. And I will talk about, like, within the context of sex in marriage, that is the most amazing thing. There is this sense of, like, wow, you and I are together. I've committed to all of you. You've committed to all of me. Mm. And because of that, there is so much more beauty in it because it's safe.
Mm.
You know, and I get that marriages fall apart, and that's the most unfortunate thing about this world in a lot of ways to me. But the reality is that in the context of a good committed marriage, sex is the most beautiful part of it because the door is closed. And it's not a bad thing that the door is closed. The reason the door is closed is so that you can be vulnerable and intimate in this space together without anybody looking in who doesn't have that same level of commitment for you, right?
Right.
And I think that's powerful. Like, we'd say, oh, the door is closed, so marriage is a trap. No, the door is closed so that you can be vulnerable and emotionally open with each other. And let me just say one more thing. The closest times where I've been spiritually, emotionally, and mentally connected to my wife have been in times surrounding the times where we were intimate with each other, like sexually intimate with each other, where you have these moments of spiritual connection and emotional connection that you cannot replicate outside of that moment, outside of that moment of intimacy. And it's not even just in the moment of intimacy. It's just in the time surrounding.
Yeah, yeah.
And there is something about that if you're not completely committed to each other, you're going to always struggle to have what it was meant to be.
Mm.
That's great. I think that's a great spot to end on, actually. That's
our
goal is to, yeah.
You just said that, Sean. I feel like I just have one more thing to say, which is
no,
you're nope. You're going to filibuster me.
Go for it. No, go for it. I want to hear it.
No, I think one of the biggest lies of our culture is that freedom means no restrictions at all.
Yeah.
Because I think there's this idea, like something that I've said in Bible class with high schoolers before is like, you know, you can have sex with people without being married and it could be fine and it could be great and you could have a fun time. Like, it's not, and I think we have to acknowledge that it could be great and it can be awesome. It can feel good. It can feel amazing and it can be a great experience. And maybe you walk away feeling like that was great or like that was just part of, you know, whatever. But we have this idea that like, that's what freedom is, that like ultimate personal freedom is like, I get to do whatever I want with whoever I want to do it with. Yeah. And like, it's great. But I think
we're two consenting adults, so it's
okay. Right. We're two consenting. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think the reality is that there's a principle within the structure of the universe, I think, in the world, that restriction actually creates more freedom and not less. So if you're in a plane, like, you wouldn't want to be in a plane that has no roof, and you would be dead immediately. And so like in the case of being in an airplane, restriction actually creates the ability for you to flourish and sort of live and not be dead. And there's just so many more examples of that, you know, like a campfire within a fireplace, you know, like creates warmth and heat and life and joy, but then, you know, released, you know, there's been ton of fires in California, you know, City of Paradise just recently burned totally to the ground. I knew people who lost everything. You know, in that case,
it's destructive
and awful.
Yeah.
So like the idea that restrictions inherently create, like boundaries inherently create less freedom is actually just, it's a myth. It's not really true. And I think that's sort of what like this like cultural worldview breakdown we have when we talk about this topic.
Well, yeah. And just to hit on that in the context of marriage is, yeah, exactly. You can be so much more intimate. I can be so much more vulnerable.
Yeah.
I can be so much more honest about how scared I am about something, about how terrified I am. I can, you know, spirituality too is inherently vulnerable.
Yeah.
And so I can be so much more spiritual even with my wife and vulnerable with my wife because I'm not worried about her leaving tomorrow.
Mm.
I'm not worried about her seeing me and being like, oh yeah, I don't know if I want that in a husband.
Mm.
You know, no, she's committed to me. I'm committed to her. And so sex is the glue. It's the ultimate. It's the culmination of that.
Right.
And because of that, it makes everything around it even better. And so that is why I think it's so powerful. And that's why, maybe going back to my opinion, I think we have to continue to hold that standard up, not as a guilt trip, water bottle, dirty water bottle way,
right,
but as a, this is the ultimate of what it could be. Don't water it down.
Right, right.
Honestly, don't water it down into something that it's not.
Right.
Because if it's not what it could be, it's not what it is.
I think we can champion an alternative position, which is God's outline for joy, you know, which is sex within a committed relationship, and talk positively and use better language, which I think is what we've been saying.
All right, everyone. Just want to thank you so much for listening to this episode of Seeking What They Sought. A couple quick notes. Would you take some time to leave us a review? It super, super helps us to kind of know how we're doing. Whether you're on Google Play or the iTunes, would you just stop and leave us a review? And we would super, super appreciate it. As always, feel free to also check out the show notes below, because we tend to put more information down there for things that we're talking about. So check that out. And of course, we want to thank Eric Edstrom, our 17-time Dundee Award winning producer, for all of his hard work in making us sound great. So we will see you guys next time on Seeking What They Sought.